Hello and welcome to a new episode of Bull Talks, Dialogues and Insight from Southeast Asia, curated by the Heinrich Bull Stiftung. I'm Francie, your host, and in this video series, we bring together voices and perspectives from across the Southeast Asian region, those who are working toward a more sustainable, just, and inclusive future. We explore ideas that connect people and the Southeast Asia region from climate resilience to green innovation, from ecological wisdom to sustainability, from gender equity to democracy and human rights. Its conversation is an invitation to reflect on where we are, what is changing, and how we can move forward together. In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Chaya Watanaputi, Faculty of Social Sciences, Chiang Mai University, Thailand, about his recent paper, Ecological Wisdom in Southeast Asia, Rethinking Resilience, Justice, and Sovereignty. Welcome, Dr. Chaya, Achan Chaya. How are you today?
Hi, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here with you. I'm very well, and yes, thank you for the invitation for writing the paper with you.
Dr. Chaya, can you please introduce yourself, your position, your background, and share what first motivated you to work on political ecology and socio-environmental issues throughout your academic career?
My name is Chaya Watanaputi. I'm a faculty member of Department of Geography, Faculty of Social Sciences, Chiang Mai University. I became interested in socio-environmental issues, especially political ecology, since I did my PhD, when I worked with a group of farmers who have throughout their lives coped with environmental changes. And the thing is, we cannot always solve climate change issues from scientific and technical solution, because of the root cause of the problem is the humans themselves. And the farmers who I worked with have shown great resilience using their knowledge to cope and to gain advantages from all these problems that they face. And I think this got me to realize that the bigger problem of the climate change today is that, you know, that there are those who gain advantages from fossil fuel-based economy, while poor people in the global south, like my group of farmers, actually suffered from the impact, and also, you know, were asked to become more resilient, were asked to do so much more thing so that they can cope with all these changes. And I think this got me interested in how their knowledge can be made useful for us to rethink about climate change.
Also in your subject, you mentioned this more than human geography. And also, you believe that we live in an Anthropocene era, right? Where maybe perhaps could you explain a bit what is more than human geographies and what is Anthropocene era?
Well, more than human geography is a way to think about this world beyond the humans. So actually, we try to see that actually there are so many other things than humans that have gave rise to the world that we live today. For example, the mountains, the rivers, the forests, they have lived on the earth for billions of years, much longer than us, and they provide oxygen, they provide ecology suitable for us to live today for only a few thousand years. So they actually came before us. And so it got us to rethink that actually we are and we have never been the center of this world. Actually, there are more than just us who can shape the world in the way it is today. And also, without humans, the world will always go on to a different state, maybe not favorable to humans, but there are ways for other things, whether they are plants or animals, that they can evolve and adapt. We just fear that we cannot and we will not survive. That's why we try to control it. And that's perhaps where we have gone wrong.
So you believe the non-human actors in this planet also deserve the same rights, recognition and respect like the human actors, yeah?
Yes, definitely. And we have seen examples in recent years, like, for example, in New Zealand, in Canada, and many places in Southern America, where different groups have tried to ask for the rights for nature, the rights for the river, the rights for fish and forest, for example, so that they can have an equal legal status, just as humans do.
And what about Anthropocene era?
Anthropocene is a way to rethink the relationship between humans and nature. As I have described before, Anthropocene almost suggests that it's the era of the humans only, but actually it is not. We have benefited from resources, for using that to develop, to gain advantage in economy, for example. But that we sacrificed the nature. For example, we used fossil fuel for different countries to become much more industrialized. But in contrary, we are giving off pollution. We're giving off carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that causes climate change. So Anthropocene helps us to realize that actually for the past billion years that the Earth has always been changing. We have accelerated it much faster than all these natural processes can do it. And we did it in just maybe 200 years. That perhaps is where all these things, that all these technologies, all these economy that we thought we could control, all these knowledge that we thought we can have, all these understandings of climate change and all these natural processes. Actually, perhaps there are many unintended consequences that are laying the path unknown for us. Climate change is one of them. Transboundary haze pollution, all these river contamination from mining, for example. There are many unknown things that we yet to discover and yet to be able to control it. And this, I think, is the definition of what is the Anthropocene, is facing the unknown because of our own responsibility.
Let's get back to the main show, which is your paper, you know. Don't give out too much to our audience, but maybe please share some insight into the paper we are discussing today. And what is your understanding are the major takeaways, you know?
Well, I use examples from Indonesia, from Vietnam, from Thailand, Philippines, for example, to show that ecological wisdoms are valuable. And it has been part of cultures and always part of how people cope through environmental changes, through part of farming, fishing, coping against flooding, and for managing environmental resources. But at the same time, these knowledges that are place-based experiences have always been facing barriers or impediments through ideology and structural barriers. And now that we are facing a much broader, much larger environmental impacts, for example, climate change, my suggestion is that ecological wisdom have the potential to get us through these negative impacts. And more importantly, I suggest that ecological wisdom help us to rethink what is indigeneity, what is knowledge, and to rethink the development path that are the root cause of climate change itself.
And for you, must be a very interesting experience researching from many countries in Southeast Asia, in our region. Yeah, and I think this could be the first, because not so many research on ecological wisdom in the regional scope specific to Southeast Asia. So it's very valuable, and I recommend all our audience to check the paper. Next question, Achan. The main topic of your research in your paper is ecological wisdom. Perhaps could you explain a bit a simple definition about what is ecological wisdom, and how does understanding of more than human geographies contribute to ecological wisdom?
So first, I describe in a broader term of indigenous knowledge. So indigenous knowledge, or knowledge in general, is the knowledge about the surrounding and the relationship between people and plants and animals and the mountains and the river and so on, which is accumulated through place-based experiences and practices, and they pass on through generations. But ecological wisdom adds something a little bit more onto that, is that all these knowledge has the ethics of doing it. So when we apply such knowledge, it has to be morally and ecologically responsible. So the overall goal is to make our society better, make our environment better, make it more sustainable. So this has to be in line with the philosophy of how one culture live with its surrounding. And so modern human geography and Anthropocene helps us to understand that actually sometimes it is the plants, it's the insects, it's the river, it's the mountain that actually gave the humans the knowledge and the wisdom of how to live with them.
You mentioned one of the core concepts of understanding ecological wisdom is the concept of indigeneity. Yeah, indigeneity, which is also in our region, it's shaped in the way how the modern states, the countries this day in Southeast Asia, also perceive traditional ecological knowledge and sometimes undermine it, right? Like could be seen as old school, unmodern. Like, could you maybe explain more what is indigeneity and why the modern states in Southeast Asia sometimes disregard this indigenous knowledge?
Well, indigeneity is a concept. It's a constructed idea of how you define knowledge or persons in relation to a bigger picture of comparison between, let's say, the West and the rest, or the Europeans and Southeast Asian, right? So if you think about in the past, during the colonial times, when the European people came here, because of the differences in the cultures, because of the differences in maybe the socioeconomic status or even the weapons, seeing the differences, and they might say that they have a higher status. And so looking upon us, we are considered lower status. We are considered native or backwards or damaged or in need of help. And so these are constructed idea in order for colonization to take place or for economic exchange to be made in relation to the Western countries. With this setting, it becomes an opposition, right, between the developed and the less developed societies. And in terms of development, always we think development is progress forward, you know, going into the future, becoming more prosperous and having more better economy, for example. But to have indigeneity or to have been said to be backward or damaged or less developed, it places us at the bottom of the league of development, or at the very last, almost become something of a barrier to development. So my argument in this article is that all these indigenous knowledge and ecological wisdom have actually got people through different kinds of changes, whether it's socioeconomic and environmental changes. And actually, it may help us to rethink what is modernity, what is capitalism, or even to question the role of the state in taking the certain development path.
You mentioned the history of colonialization in the past, right? I believe that colonization also the core activity is extraction, right? And from your explanation, definitely this destroyed the environment, the non-human actors, because not regarded as equal as human actors. Do you think that in our development paradigm this day, we also need to put the colonial approach? And how would the indigenous communities in Southeast Asia, like in Thailand, Vietnam, or Indonesia, would define development?
Development has to be incorporating the past and also the present. That means development that's always inclusive of the past generation, the knowledge that is have accumulated in the past, and also opens to different kinds of knowledges in order to go forward. It does not mean a singular kinds of knowledge, and also it does not mean singular pathway of going forward. There are different ways. There are a diverse way of going forward. And I think from different case studies that I have described in the articles, they have shown that maybe the supernatural, maybe the natural, and even also different groups of ethnicity have different versions and different ways of how they perceive their own sustainability. Development then would mean a more democratic way of living rather than a single way of living their lives. And it still has to be in line with their own philosophies. And general philosophies are sustainability.
What are your recommendations on how indigenous knowledge and ecological wisdom can address the multiple crises of our times? Could you share your thoughts about this, especially in regard to the levels of policymaking and implementation?
My suggestion is that since knowledge not only becomes a tool for living and also becomes already the forms of resistance, then we need first to unlearn the Western idea of development. And so first we recognize and respect the knowledge. And second, we rebalance the hierarchy of knowledge so that different groups appreciate this mundane indigenous knowledge or ecological wisdom. All these knowledge holders can become more than just knowledge holders. They become more active. For example, in terms of citizen science, instead of doing the things in their lives just as they do now, perhaps they can document their own knowledge and turn that into numbers. And these numbers, for example, they could count how many fish varieties they have in their rivers. They can count how many species that there are in the forest. And these are the rivers and the forests that they have protected for hundreds and hundreds of years through their ecological wisdom. The numbers are something that states or even scientists really like because it's countable, right? And this can be a proof, you know, indirect proof that their knowledge has values, that if there is any activities damaging the forest or the rivers, they can say, you know, X number of fish or animals will be lost because of some impacts. They can use their knowledge as a weapon, as a form of resistance against all these incoming projects. Another thing that we can do is that at many times, scientific communications are always about numbers. And yes, I also suggest that numbers is one way of achieving resistance, but also we have to go beyond the numbers too. Ecological wisdom and indigenous knowledge is best at telling stories, singing songs, or telling myths, or making performance arts, for example. And this perhaps is a very profounding way of touching, capturing our hearts and our feelings, that we want to go beyond instrumental values of development, but towards the more intrinsic values. And these will be these stories, these legends that tells, you know, from the past generations to our generations, and also to the future, will be a very essential tool for rethinking Eurocentricism, technocentricism, and also capitalism.
Are you hopeful that this knowledge, ecological wisdom, could be translated by the modern states in Southeast Asia to the level of policymaking? Because, of course, definitely you need policymakers that understand that these values, this wisdom, in order to make policy that kind of protect and conserve the environment, give the same mutual respect to the non-human actors. Are you hopeful, Dr. Chaya?
I am hopeful, and I hope for better. At the time of writing this article, in Thailand, the indigenous bill was in the process of review. And in the past month or so, it has been passed. So I am hopeful that indigenous knowledge and ecological wisdoms and all these basic human rights for indigenous people will be protected and will be appreciated much, much more than in the past. But I am not so sure about how we go forward. Now that we have the bill with it, so that's a good thing. But if we look at in a global scale, for example, and learn from the past, actually, there are always different kinds of projects, different kinds of mechanism where there are ways for reproducing exploitation of resources or turning indigenous people as just a labor in environmental protection. For example, in the case of climate mitigation and carbon forestry scheme, for example, yes, in Thailand there are many, many carbon forest projects starting in the past maybe 2 or 3 years. But I'm not sure for the next 5 years or 10 years whether the indigenous people will be reduced to just a labor in protecting the forest, or will they be appreciated because of they themselves has the knowledge? This, I think, we will have to see. But from the examples in other regions, there are mixed results, you know, of indigenous people having their rights and legal status in protecting their environment. So I'm hopeful, but I'm a little bit doubtful also in how in Southeast Asia we go about this use of environmental protection as an excuse for further exploitation of not just only people, but also different kinds of resources.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chaya Watanaputi, for speaking to us today and for sharing your valuable insight with our audience. Stay tuned for the next episode of Bold Talks, Dialogues and Insight from Southeast Asia, where we continue exploring the ideas, peoples, and stories driving change around Southeast Asia.